And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back, listeners, to the Warwick Medical School Technology Podcast, focusing this week on the huge topic of AI in healthcare through the lens of Medical School Council Competency Number 5. And we are delighted to have with us in the studio today, Dr. Faris Al-Ramadani. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me, Hamish.
No problem. We're always great to have a local lad. So thanks for coming on. We met first at the Digital Health Rewired conference a few months ago now, is that right?
It was a few months ago, wasn't it? Time flies. But yeah, no, we met there. That was a really good event, and one of those good events that brings together technology and healthcare and sort of, you know, really interesting conversations. So yeah, it was a few months ago, but thanks for inviting me.
No, I saw the opportunity and I thought, this guy is a Warwick graduate, so he'll be just the right guy for the show. So why don't you talk our listeners through your journey all the way back from, you know, back to the medical school in, when was that?
Yeah, so I was at Warwick Medical School 2006 to 2010. I came here as a postgraduate in the early days of Warwick Medical School as an independent medical school. Qualified here, I did my foundation training in Coventry and Warwickshire. Mm-hmm. I did my GP training in Coventry and Warwickshire as well.
Okay, so and you really know the area.
I really know the area, and I've stayed ever since. So I was born in Leamington, but grew up elsewhere and came back for medical school. And brilliant place to be. Loved it here and stayed ever since, and really happy. Did my GP training here, and then took up a partnership soon after qualifying, and then my roots were laid and here I am.
Oh, brilliant. And you're a partner at Southam Surgery, is that right?
Well, it's St Wolston Surgery.
Oh, yeah, there's two in Southam, aren't there?
There's two in Southam. So I'm a partner at St Wolston Surgery in Southam, one of the two there, yeah.
Brilliant. And I noted online that you at that surgery were the top Google rated GP surgery in the UK. Is that right? In 2025?
Yeah, it's a brilliant place to be. It's a fabulous surgery, great staff, a great setup. And what makes it really special is its relationship with its patients. It's a CQC outstanding practice. It's got amongst the highest scores in the country for patient satisfaction. So I think it was sort of joint top for larger surgeries last year in the national survey, and we were the Healthcare Service Journal Primary Care Provider of the Year nationally in 24 and 25. So busy place to be, but brilliant, and it's sort of a great place that sort of demonstrates that ethos of working with the community, surgery and staff working with patients, and it's a good place to be.
Brilliant. Okay, well, I'd like you to just talk our listeners through your journey into the digital health arena from a general practice background.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting journey. I mean, it's a very organic journey, so I'm not going to tell you anything too earth-shattering. But, you know, being a GP partner in a practice is a unique and privileged position, I think, because you're simultaneously managing the demands of being a clinician with running an organisation and developing and maturing that organisation, and at the same time improving the environment for staff and improving the environment and the sort of care that we deliver to the patients. Mm-hmm. So you're really invested in all avenues, and you have to have that complete 360. So being a partner, like I said, is a really privileged position, but part of that is trying to identify where we can do better. And we can keep doing better. And today we can do better in many ways. And it's that constant drive to try and improve things. And what I really like is where, you know, technology has the power to improve not just the patient experience, but the staff experience. Okay. And when you're improving both, you're simultaneously improving the surgery itself. So, you know, I commonly term it an ecosystem, but it really is one, you know, where there's disillusionment and dissatisfaction in one of those parties, it has an impact elsewhere. You know, if patients are really annoyed and really angry and they come and see you as a GP, you're not going to have a great experience because they're unhappy.
And that'll bleed into the patient relationship and the staff relationships.
Exactly. That's exactly it. So technology became one of those really useful instruments for how do we make things better. And then that's where that kind of opened the doors. I did a bit of consultancy with digital technology companies whilst being a GP partner. So kind of was exposed to that environment, you know, spoke to the right people, built the right relationships. I was always interested in the technology. And as a practice, we started working with digital technology companies to bring new technology in into the surgery, and we developed sort of the implementation programs around those. You know, how do we make technology work well? We had to build structures around the governance for how to do that safely and appropriately, but also to gather feedback from patients and staff and look at outcomes. So we actually worked quite closely with Tandem Health when implementing an ambient AI scribe.
And Tandem Health, they were acquired or integrated into Accurix. Is that correct?
Yeah. So they're the Tandem Health's product is sold in the UK or in England into the NHS through Accurix. So they worked together basically to bring Tandem and Accurix together, which is why lots of people now know about that technology.
Because Accurix was widely deployed some of our listeners who wouldn't know that within the primary care environment, and they were looking for a scribe in competition with things like Heidi Scribe and so forth. And that's probably where that came from.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's where it came from. So that's where that relationship came from. As you said, Accurix had significant market share in England amongst GP surgeries, but didn't have a scribe offer. We're going into a point now where everyone wants a scribe offer. Mm-hmm. And so then they found they developed a collaboration, and the partner that they chose was Tandem Health. We started doing our work with Tandem Health before then. So we were actually sort of amongst the first in England, I think, to use that technology with Tandem Health. But the difference was we sort of collaborated with them. We kind of worked with them to develop a really good implementation structure, mm-hmm. get the governance right first time, and really gather the data on real world evidence as to what the impact was going to be, which was a brilliant program and really a brilliant project. And that work itself then created the foundations for what we called sort of the St. Wolfston Digital Accelerator program, where we could bring other technology in and deploy it or sort of run it through a similar rigor and then try and get those benefits, all with the idea of, you know, a lot of things will depend on the quality of the implementation. So if we can really refine the implementation and get that bit right, we can then hopefully start to deliver the benefits of that technology sooner.
Well, I think actually there's loads of great things there what we want to unpack, especially with regard to things like the governance and some of the barriers. So let's kick off with that really. So if we think about the limitations and the barriers to the integration of AI in healthcare, you know, using examples such as the AI scribes, they were, you know, they're one of the big adoptions so far. What have you, what important points were you considering there? You talked about the governance and, the DPIAs, which is a data protection impact assessments and so forth.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a very big subject, but it's critical. It's absolutely critical. The barriers, really, you could describe the governance around this as a barrier, but really it's a safeguard. It's a guardrail. It's the way that we ensure that what we're doing is right and it's safe and we're optimizing the technology that we've been given access to. So that governance really starts, ultimately it all starts with a problem, and it starts with a solution that meets the problem. So, you know, ambient scribes came along because they gave the benefit of, from a clinician, reducing the documentation time that they have to spend, the cognitive load associated with that, but it also enhanced that relationship between patient and doctor, which in itself gave a significant benefit. So there was a problem, there was a good solution with the ambient scribe, which worked well. And so then the question about governance comes in. How do you then safely deploy that? And there's a lot to take in, but it's actually the more you do this process, the easier it becomes. So you're right. You start with the product. You do a DPIA, data protection impact assessment. And what that essentially means, what a data protection impact assessment is essentially doing, is looking at the data flows. Where does the data go when using this piece of technology, and can we ensure the security of that data flow? Is it appropriate, and does that work properly? So that's the data protection impact assessment. And the DPIA, really, we're trying to identify whether there's any shortcomings there. Do we know where the data flow is, and are we confident that that data flow is secure? Once that's done, because there's someone else involved in processing data, you have to review and renew your data privacy statements. So that's another bit that the practice has to do. And then after that, you come into the sort of beefier part of the work, which is the clinical safety. And here you come across a limiting factor, because the clinical safety aspect is conducted through what's called the DCB0160. It's a process that we follow to identify clinical risks that might emanate from the use of this technology, and we have to try and mitigate those risks where we can, and then we have to decide on the balance whether there is an acceptable or unacceptable risk by the deployment of this technology. Now, that requires a digital clinical safety officer. I am a digital clinical safety officer. The NHS does offer training to train doctors to become clinical safety officers. It's a really good thing to do. It's been a brilliant thing that I found to do. But not all practices will have one. And that's where you hit a bottleneck. So we have got that, so we were then able to complete the DCB0160. Once that's done, a lot of the governance is done. But around the DCB work, you will have those mitigations that I was talking about. And some of that will be about creating internal processes. So standard operating procedures. You need to ensure that people are using the technology safely and consistently. And the framework and mechanism for doing that is the standard operating procedure that all staff should be encouraged to follow to ensure the safe use of the technology. So then you're sort of building that work out. And once that's done, then you're really ready to go with implementing. You train. Onboard staff, make sure they know how the technology works and what they're doing with it, and then you're in a position where you can start to run with that. And when you're running with that, there's still that process of audit, so it's still about checking to make sure that people are doing the right thing and it is giving the right outputs, and you're trying to identify any problems as they're arising.
We'll come to the validation and the post-deployment analysis in a second there, but just drilling down a bit on the things like the data sharing agreement. So you mentioned there with with the Accurix Scribe and the flows of data. Where is the data stored currently with Accurix Scribe, and did that create any problems for you when you were doing the DPIA and so forth?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was very interesting, and my practice manager, I could have throttled me, I think, at the time for going through this work, because traditional data flows were quite simple, but AI, it sort of introduces a new complexity to that. Absolutely. You know, you really have to then start to understand data flows in a slightly different way, and it is more complicated. So it does deliver a higher level of complexity in this work, but it's not insurmountable. So for example, an ambient scribe, what you're looking for is what's being recorded, what's being stored, and where is it being stored. So with the ambient scribes, generally they're not recording, they are taking a very short snippet of the conversation that's happening and transmitting that into a transcribed note. But it doesn't do it all in one entire note. It breaks it into fragments and stores it in different servers or in different locations of those servers. And then later on, that's brought back together. Those servers have to be EU-based, ideally UK-based, but EU-based, so that we are within that geographical envelope. And that's generally how most of these scribes work. They use servers which are housed within the EU, and the actual voice recording is not stored. It's merely transcribed, and then the AI is putting together the transcribed words and formatting it into something that makes sense from a clinical perspective. No patient identifiable data travels with that. So at the moment, you know, our use of Tandem, for example, is independent of the electronic patient record system. So Tandem cannot see the patient who we are looking at or speaking to. So it's not identifiable. Obviously, that's not completely robust, because that patient could suffer with a rare condition and there might only be one person in the country who suffers with that. So there's still the risk of identifiable.
Of the de-anonymization later on.
Exactly.
And how did that work when Accurix Scribe started to be able to recognize the patient details? Does that change the situation? Because there's a feature now on it where you use the scribe function and then it it gives you an option to save that directly to the patient record, and it recognises who it is and it flashes up on the screen. Did that change that situation or?
Yeah, and that's a really good point. And we didn't actually work with Accurix on this, so I haven't been into the detail of how Accurix is processing that side of things. What you do see is, because, you know, if we were to look at maybe moving from Tandem Health into Accurix, you get a bit of a cold sweat because you've got to go through the whole thing again. Mm. And that's the sort of detail that you've got to look at. I know, say, with Tandem, for example, what happened was when you've got the transcribed note, you would click transfer into the patient record. Mm. And it would just use an RPA function. So it would literally be just copy and paste, essentially. So it wouldn't be reading any data from the electronic patient record system. It would merely be copy and pasting that transcribed note into the record. I would assume there'd be something similar. The only difference with Accurix compared to that is that Accurix is using an API into EMIS, whereas the Tandem offer itself within its own product was an RPA.
Well, brilliant. Thank you very much. Yeah, we could talk for all day about that, I'm sure. So now let's talk about briefly the role of big data in healthcare. Okay, so big data, it's not all about spreadsheets. It's about how everyday clinical work turns into decisions and systems and population health. And there's a whole load of opportunities available to us as we start to consider that, moving from reactive care to proactive care. I wondered, you know, what sort of experience you have in that area.
Yeah, and this is where the superpower starts to be released, isn't it? When we can actually look at real population health data and actually make some genuine insights into that. So this is a huge area. My experience of this is, you know, locally within Coventry and Warwickshire, the ICB, the Integrated Care Board, commissioned a solution for population health data called Healthy Intent. It's a, you know, sort of a really good dashboard, and that dashboard is pulling in data at present from primary care and secondary care sources. So it's a really powerful tool. And this is the sort of thing, now I wouldn't say that there's an AI link here really. Essentially, it's collecting that data and it's presenting it in a dashboard. So we haven't got to the point locally where we have an AI-driven solution. We literally have data being collected in a central place and a dashboard to display that data. It's then for the human to access that data and make the insights. But here really is the key part. The data collection is not the problem, right? We're collecting data all the time, our hospitals, our primary care facilities. We've got a lot of data. We've got to pull the data, and that's what Healthy Intent, the dashboard that we use, is doing.
So this is about integration of the already existing data.
Exactly. Collate the data from those various sources. We'll probably speak about this later, but the problem is if you rely on one data set or one data source, you'll get a bias because you've got to account for the, you know, sort of the complete patient experience. Collating that information is where we're at the moment. But you soon realize that you can collate all the data that you want. And actually, it's not the data that means that much to you, it's the insights that matter to you, right? You need the insight and you need to be able to understand that data, interpret that data, and start to be able to identify what that data is telling you. We aren't there yet with being able to do that well or efficiently or effectively. So I think that what we're probably going to see over time is AI tools that will then interpret that data, provide those insights, and then actually that's where the real power comes in.
Yeah, and there's huge opportunity there with, you know, identifying where the high-risk groups and moving to that proactive level of care. You know, there are some tensions with that though, aren't there, with regard to the increasing use of big data. So you know, the NHS, you know, runs on trust, and the big data only works if the patients believe their data is safe. Do you feel that patients are adequately consulted about this new integration, or do you feel there are any other issues in that area?
I would say from personal experience, patients are informed, and I would say patients generally are in favour of anything that will improve care for themselves or for their population and their community. So I think people are open to that. I think there is obviously the There is the risk that people don't have confidence in where that data goes. And I think that's going to be the big thing. It's the trust word, isn't it? People need to trust where their data is going and who's handling their data. And I think over time that will be an increasingly important conversation to have. But I don't think it, you know, I don't think it sort of ends this process of development. I think people want to contribute towards making things better. And I think people generally are happy to have their data looked at in a way that will help them. But yes, I think trust is going to be a fundamental issue going forward. And we're already seeing some of that coming out at the moment.
And rightly so. Yep. So we touched earlier on the real world clinical validation. So and I want to go back to that now. So we talked about how the AI tools, you know, in their initial setting, in their initial testing, they can look really impressive. But unless they're tested and validated properly in the real clinical settings in which we exist, then, you know, they can really harm patients. How would you expand on that concept?
Yeah, and I think this is brilliant. I think it's really astute to mention that, Hamish, to be honest, because look, you know, if you assume that the software is the football boot, a football boot on my right foot is different to a football boot on Ronaldo's right foot. It's not the tool necessarily that is the distinguishing feature for success. It's the way that we use it. So the more skilled we are in being able to use that technology or that device, the more chance we've got of success. So there's a few fundamentals, I think, and I think the fundamentals boil down to, do we have a problem? Do we have a problem that we want to fix? If we've got a problem that we want to fix, what's the tool that we've got available, or what is the selection of tools? How do we identify the most appropriate tool for the problem? Once we've identified the most appropriate tool for the problem, how do we make sure that we deploy it to get the very best out of it? Don't give it to me if it's a football boot, give it to Ronaldo and it's going to do much better. And that's really how it works, you know. And as healthcare providers, really there's a strong focus on us. You know, we really need to embrace that technology. We need to understand how it works, and we have to be the ones that provide the interface, that really powerful interface between the technology and the people that are going to benefit from it. So it all boils down to me in a very large way to the success of your implementation. And that's the bit that unfortunately people often don't have enough time. You know, it doesn't matter how good the tool is, it's how well we use it, how well we deploy it, how well we appraise it, how well we audit it, how well we refine it, and how well we explain those benefits to staff, and how much we involve staff into that deployment and that solution. So it's a real art form, I think, but that's the key. I think it's really important.
That's a really good point, you know. And the validation isn't just about the accuracy of the tool, it's whether it actually improves our real use case in our clinical scenarios. And in healthcare, the moving fast and breaking things paradigm that's proactively used and adopted in the technology scenarios isn't really acceptable. And I think it's really important for our listeners to consider that their active involvement in the iterative design and the iterative evolution of these products, once we begin to integrate and adapt them into our clinical settings, is paramount. They have to be involved there.
100%. And actually, you know, as purchasers of the technology within the NHS, we need to think about who we're dealing with. It's a really key point, this, because actually you want to develop, you use the word iterative, and iteration is really key, because nothing's ever going to be perfect from day one. Everything needs refinement and improvement, and you don't go a week without there being a new app update on your mobile phone. You know, that's really important. We have to keep moving forward. So when we're choosing providers vendors who are supplying us with software solutions, we need to make sure we're choosing suppliers who are willing to iterate. They're willing to listen to feedback. They're willing to upgrade and develop their products. And actually, there's nothing more frustrating when something doesn't work and no one's developing it, no one's moving it forward, no one's solving the problems that we've got with that piece of technology.
Thank you. Okay. Earlier on, we were talking about data sets and how the clinical validation was important because the data sets may not be applicable to our current clinical settings. For example, you know, this was a tool derived in an urban setting. We're moving it to a more rural population or a UK clinical scenario, clinical setting, when the training data set was all over in the US. So, and of course, within any local population, you have other diversity, which is really important to consider. So When we're talking about kind of avoiding biases within our data sets, have you got anything to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's obvious, isn't it? So AI is going to require data, and the more data, the more effective and more efficient that AI system is going to be. There is the risk of data bias and the fact that we're not providing data inputs from across the spectrum of healthcare providers. So it's very important that the models are built and developed on a broad range of data sets. I think that as a clinician on the ground, this is something I don't see. This will be really very much for those people creating that technology. But what you will see is it's the quality of the data in. The thing that I've learned, even from something as basic as an AI scribe, is it's only as good as what you put in. If any of us who have used any form of ChatGPT or any form of AI, it's all dependent on the quality of the data you feed it. So don't be annoyed if the output is rubbish, because your input could have been rubbish, right? So the better the input, the better the output. So the broader a range of data that we feed into these systems, the more likely we're going to get better outcomes at the end of it. But like I said, as a clinician, I won't see so much of that. But the quality of the product that we're going to be investing in and using going forward will be dependent on that work. So you would expect and hope that the people creating that technology will be using data sets that will ensure that when we do deploy technology, we're getting the best out of it, and actually we're getting something that's going to enhance the care that we deliver. So it's really in everybody's interest that that data is right and the quality of the outputs are right, because if they're not, we're not going to use the technology. But worse than that, we might end up making wrong decisions, and that's where you've got your human in the loop and the human oversight at all time.
That's a really important point. Now I want to move on away from data biases to something that's quite pertinent to our target audience, our medical students, and we're going to talk about automation bias, because the more uncertain you feel, the more tempting it is to rely on our system. And I wonder if you had had any experience with automation bias, and if you had anything to say about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all probably subconsciously have been subject to that automation bias. You could be feeding some information into an AI engine because you want to go on holiday and you want an itinerary to follow on your holiday. I found that to be a particularly useful use case for the use of AI. But you want an easy life, or you trust it too much, and actually you're going to follow that plan, that itinerary that it creates for you, without really being objective, because actually it's just easier. And actually we are getting increasing confidence in the use of AI at the moment. So I think many of us have got that sort of automation bias without really even necessarily knowing about it. Now, it's one thing on a holiday itinerary, we'll let that one slip, but it's a completely different situation when it comes to patient care, and when we're looking after patients. And this is, this is really, really key. Even when using an ambient scribe, when you are saving the clinical record in the electronic patient record system, you are responsible as the clinician. It doesn't matter what the AI scribe has come up with. If you save it, it's yours, no matter how good or bad the outputs from the AI scribe are. So it's really important that you try and overcome that automation bias. I think, being a doctor, there is that thing we're trained with. You do have to think, we all know about safety netting. Safety netting implies that we are thinking about the negative outcomes that might come from our consultation. It's about thinking about what could go wrong. Those quarter equina red flag symptoms, they're not there now and they're very, very rare, but we've got it in the back of our head. So we give that safety netting about what they should be looking out for and what they should do. So I think as clinicians, we do have that built into us to be critical, to think about what could be, what could happen, what those negative outcomes could be. But we need to make sure that we maintain that same rigor that we employ in a clinical setting like that to the use of AI as well. We need to think, what if the AI's got this wrong? How am I going to think? How am I going to act work differently or how I'm going to change my management plan based on that risk. So I think that, you know, it will be there because we will often look for the, you know, save time and just save and, you know, move on as quickly as we can. But actually, we can't do that. We do have to be rigorous and we do have to double check and we do have to think about what happens when this is going wrong. And I think it's something we'll learn. We'll learn over time. But I would just, you know, caution people, you know, don't rely on AI. You know, you've got to be the human in the loop who's overseeing that. And the decision is ultimately yours. And when it comes to an AI scribe, I think the thing that I learned from that was an 80-20 rule. You know, it's capable of doing 80% of the work, but there's still 20% left for me. And I've got that final 20%, which is checking that work, refining that work, and making sure it's appropriate and it's right. And that for me feels right. You know, it's going to save you some time, but you're not going to rely on it. You need to be the one who takes that responsibility.
Yeah, absolutely. You can't defend a decision by saying the computer told me to. And spot the good on. Clinicians don't compete with machines, they just supervise them. The safest use of AI isn't blind trust, it is thoughtful skepticism. So we're moving on to our final thoughts now. So, AI in healthcare, it's not just a technical problem, it's a clinical one. Without rigorous real-world validation, even the most validated tools can be unsafe. And as future doctors, your role is not just to use these symptoms, but to question them. Before we wrap up, what would our guests' top three things be they'd want every medical student to take away from this podcast?
That's a brilliant question. Okay, so we've got three things. The first thing is remain curious. Always be curious. Just because we do things in a certain way, don't just expect that that's the right way. Very often we're doing things in a poor way that could be much more efficient. So be curious about what we're doing, why we're doing it, and could we be doing it better? You are the future generation who can make a really big difference, but clinicians need to lead. Clinicians need to be confident enough to question what we're doing. So I'd say be curious because you are part of the future solution. I would say be cautious. We've just spoken about automation bias, and I think it's really important that we be aware of the pitfalls of technology and we don't become overly dependent or reliant on it. We still have the knowledge. AI might make things quicker, it might find insights, but we are that point of contact with patients. So be curious, but be cautious. And the third item is be optimistic. So the technology is making impact both for us as clinicians. So, you know, as clinicians, we do lots of mundane, boring processes and note keeping is one of those. So AI has the power to step in and make a difference and make our working life better. But it's not just for us as the staff, it's our patients too. So we're using automation at the moment to improve patient recall. You know, we're now at the point where we're the safest we've ever been when it comes to chronic disease, blood test monitoring and chronic disease reviews. So we're raising the quality of the care that we're delivering. So the optimism comes from the fact that technology might make your life better, it might make your life more simple and allow you to spend time doing the things that you really like doing, like speaking to patients. But it's also allowing us now to be optimistic about the care that we deliver to patients, more effective, more personalized, more efficient. So a lot to be excited about, I think.
Well, brilliant. That's we've learned so much today. So thank you very much for your time and your expertise. I'm sure all our listeners will have learned a lot. Please check our homepage for the links and transcript from this episode, where you can subscribe using the yellow RSS feed button. And please get in touch if you have any burning questions in digital health for our next episode via the linked feedback form.